This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 FM and 92.5 FM in good old McLean County and Bloomington Normal, 88.3 in Pontiac, 97.1 in Lincoln, covering much of central Illinois. We're going to have a great show for you today. I hope everyone out there had a very happy Thanksgiving. We did, and we had the whole weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday that we took, and had the Thanksgiving dinner with some of our children and friends, and it was a very nice time. I hope you had a great time, too. Remember, the show here and all of the shows on this station are brought to you by you, so we depend on you. And if you can make a donation to the station, we would very much appreciate it. Anything that you can give would be appreciated. You can call us at 309-807-2427. Again, that's 309-807-2427. Or you can go to our website, better yet, and that is CatholicSpiritRadio.com. Again, that is CatholicSpiritRadio.com. And if you go to that website, it will tell you more about us and what we do, and it will tell you how you can help us out and how to make a donation there. So go there and find out more about us. You'll be glad you did. We're going to today have a little bit of a review of the Roe situation, the abortion situation. The Supreme Court is rehearing, actually sort of reviewing and rehearing Roe. It's hearing a case, Jackson Dobbs case in concerning Jackson, Mississippi, and it will have to make a decision, and that decision could mean rejecting Roe, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. Before we start, if my wife Lynn has something to say, I want her to say it now, and then we'll get into that, and we'll talk more about the abortion situation. We did talk about it before, but I'm going to go in a little bit of a different direction this time, and we'll talk about what the situation might be like if Roe is actually overturned. So that's what we'll get into. And before we do, I'm going to turn this over to Lynn and see what she has to say.
Well, we're in the first week of Advent, going into the second, and we're waiting for, as John says in his gospel, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it, and it still hasn't. So we wait for Christmas and the celebrating of the coming of Christ, our Savior. Keep that in mind with all your shopping and so forth. I think the topic you've chosen, Bob, is very good and very interesting. There's a lot of it that I quite don't understand and would like to know more about. So you want to begin?
Yeah, well, I want to put a plug in for next week for people to be sure and listen to our show next week. I'm going to be here with Carl Winning, and he is going to talk about the radio station, and he'll give you a lot of information. We're going to talk about what we've done, what we're doing, where we're trying to go, what we're trying to do, and what our expenses and costs have been, and all of the various things that go into running a station. It's going to be a very, very interesting show, so make sure you tune in next week and listen to it, and you'll be glad, because you'll find out a lot about us by listening to that. And Carl is very, very well-spoken and well-versed in everything that goes on at this station, and all of the input that is necessary in order to keep us going, and again, where we're going to go in Illinois, some of the things we're trying to do to expand, and how it will affect you and help you. So be sure to tune in then. But at any rate, Lynn, I'm going to go ahead and talk then about the Roe situation. We talked a month or two ago about the case coming up in Mississippi. It's being heard right now, and probably there won't be a ruling on it for quite some time. It won't be probably until this spring or summer, maybe as late as June, somewhere in there. But I read
usually the end of June.
Yeah. and I read from an article in First Things magazine, Roe Must Go. I want to review that, just to review what's at stake here and review a little bit about the either-or situation that this particular case in Mississippi puts the abortion question in. And so you'll have an idea of why this is such an important hearing and why it's very likely that Roe could go in this. And but the important thing is why so much talk about an emphasis on abortion in the last 50 years in the first place, and what is going to happen if Roe does go. What will the situation be like, and why did the situation get this way in the first place, and why is there such a division in this country over it? We're going to talk a little bit about that and see if we can arrive at some answers. But at any rate, I'm going to read from this article. It's by Robert George, and I've read from it before, but this will give you a good review of what's going on. It says, the reason that Roe will go, according to Robert George, and he is a McCormick professor of jurisprudence and director of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton University. He says that if politicization means making the court seem driven by politics rather than law, Roe and Casey are the ultimate causes of politicization. In having this court stick by those precedents when they are squarely at issue would only heighten the impression that the court is doing politics and not doing law. For the public knows that the court is majority originalist. In other words, we have six members on that court that declare that their idea of the Constitution and constitutional law is originalism, that is to try to stick as close as they can with the original meaning of the Constitution. And that originalism can't be squared with Roe and Casey. So if the court maintained those precedents against a head-on challenge, no one in the nation would doubt that it had done so for the fear of political fallout. And this signal that the court is susceptible to political blackmail would only deepen the problem. And then the point is that the Roe and Casey, which was a rehashing of Roe at a later time, both of those really have no precedent in good constitutional law. Even at the time of the decisions about Roe and Casey, there were very liberal scholars who were in favor of abortion, but nevertheless pointed out that there was absolutely no precedent in law and no real grounds to make the decisions that were made at the time of Roe and at the time of Casey. And so even they admitted that it's very, very convoluted, and there's nothing in the Constitution that says that there can't be a regulation of abortion. And Roe pretty much almost stopped any regulation at all. So that's something that is going to be very difficult for six people on that court dedicated to originalism to some way try and find a way to preserve Roe and at the same time preserve their integrity. It's going to be very, very difficult to do. Second, though other cases might have left room to uphold an abortion regulation without fully overruling Roe and Casey or resorting to made-up rationales, this case does not. Any such ruling would have to rest on reasoning that was groundless, vague, or entrenching of some sort of abortion right. It would either exacerbate the court's reputation for politicized decision-making, multiply its forays into the political war zone, or extend the damage done to our legal and political order by Roe and Casey's survival. So it's very, very, very difficult for anyone without fudging, and that's exactly what the last court did in arriving at Roe and then even further arriving at it, its expansion, actually, in Casey. And it would be very difficult to do that again when it's caused so much trouble in the first place. Third, development this summer makes it clear that a failure to overturn Roe and Casey outright would do more than increase those precedents' immediate harms. It would shatter the conservative legal movement. Scores of filings in Dobbs suggest that the conservative legal movement now sees this case as the ultimate test of this court's position on reversing Roe, which is in turn the ultimate test of the court's commitment to constitutionalism. Anything less than reversal of Roe would be a wholesale defect or defeat for the conservative legal movement. It would put wind into the sails of critics who have in recent years claimed that the conservative legal establishment is faking a commitment to restoring the courts to principled constitutional reasoning and is really only interested in securing judgeships for its cronies. So it would be a very, very difficult decision not to overturn Roe. And we'll see that the situation is such that you either, if you rule in favor of Jackson, Mississippi, if you rule in favor of Mississippi, you're going to have to overturn Roe. And if you rule in favor of, you know, of Roe, there's no way that you can accommodate the constitutionalism of Mississippi. I mean, you're in a situation where you have to do one thing or the other. There is no way to fudge and have some kind of compromise in this situation. It just is not possible. And so to rule in the opposite way, and that is without overturning Roe, the judges who are going to have to repudiate their own idea of constitutional law. And they're going to have to, in other words, give in to political forces, and everyone would know it. So they're really being put on the spot. So the judges would have done this against their own professional legal philosophy in order to placate progressive elites or out of fear of them. Everyone on the left and right alike would know exactly what they were doing. And finally, even if a halfway option in Dobbs could help the court preserve political capital, as it cannot really, doing so would be pointless. The only reason to preserve capital is to spend it on cases in which the rule of law requires a hard decision and the stakes are high. And the stakes are nowhere higher than with Roe and Casey. And no two cases are more disruptive of the rule of law. Because the decisions in Roe and Casey really actually corrupt the Constitution, and they have been a problem ever since. And even the most liberal legal scholars admit that. Even people in favor of abortion admit that the way that these decisions were arrived at and their consequences simply are not compatible with constitutional law. So refusing to spend capital to overturn them would be like refusing to apply to college because the application fee would have to come out of your college savings account. In other words, it just doesn't make sense. A timid decision in Dobbs would be a grave loss for the rule of law, the most grievous loss since Roe itself. So those are some of the issues that are going to be at stake here and that are going to drive this whole debate and discussion and this whole looking at Roe, and they certainly are going to drive it in the direction of overturning Roe. Roe invented a constitutional entitlement to elective abortion effectively at all stages. The Constitution defines no right to elective abortion, much less one so sweeping. Indeed, for the next several decades, Roe's failure as a piece of legal reasoning became a point of near consensus, even in the liberal legal academy. Eminent legal scholar, dean of Stanford Law School, and avowed supporter of legal abortion, John Hart Ely, wrote that Roe was not constitutional law and gave almost no appearance of an obligation to even try to be. So, I mean, this is coming from the other side. And so it's going to be very difficult for judges who are pledged to constitutional law and originalism not to overturn Roe. So at any rate, it says here the Roe is based on a very, very Judge Kennedy, for example, said in I think this was in Casey, which actually extends Roe and makes it instead of revising Roe, it actually abolished a lot of the restrictions in Roe and made the abortion rights almost unlimited. And his was based on the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Because beliefs about these matters could not define the attributes of personhood, were they formed under compulsion of the state. And Casey explained that it was adhering to Roe because admitting Roe's mistakes in the face of widespread criticism would have undermined the court's credibility. This is ridiculous, really. Thus, bizarrely, did universal recognition of Roe's bankruptcy become the leading reason to cling to it. And this is bizarre. In fact, this is they were reaching for some kinds of reasons in order to not only keep Roe, but even extend it. And we're going to get into what Judge Kennedy said here about this woman's right, about, in other words, to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, and of the universe and the mystery of human life. Where did he pick this from? And how does it bear on abortion? And what was really driving the abortion debate in the first place? And how did Harry Blackmun arrive at the idea that the Constitution had to provide for abortion? I mean, there's more going on here than meets the eye. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the crux of the situation with Roe. We're going to talk about why there was such a drive for abortion in the first place and, you know, what is a driving force behind it. So all of those things we're going to get at and when we talk about this a little bit further. And that's what I really want to talk about today. And I just wanted to set up the whole idea of what's happening here. And I'm going to do that a little more clearly in the next segment, exactly what the Roe, I mean, what the Dobbs case is. And again, why it's such an either-or situation. And then what drove the whole abortion debate and the decision of the Supreme Court in the first place to go down that path? And what is still driving it today? And what will be the reaction if Roe is overturned? And why will that reaction happen? I mean, what's really going on here? So that's what we're going to get at in the next two sections. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
This Christmas season, help Catholic Spirit Radio pack the van for Catholic Charities. The St. Nicholas Charity on Wheels Ministry, a traveling van, needs donations for distribution to the poor. Spirit Radio listeners are encouraged to pack the van with needed goods on the first three Saturdays of December. Please drop off donations at the station from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Visit CatholicSpiritRadio.com for details.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. And we're talking about the Roe decision that will be coming up, the Casey decision that will be coming up that will affect on Roe and Casey. And it's the Dobbs case in Mississippi. And I'm going to explain that and make it clear. And so we'll go into, you know, what the exact case is in Mississippi and why it puts the situation in a very, very stark setting, a very, very stark situation where there has to be almost an either or. It's going to be very difficult to have any kind of compromise on this issue. And the judges that are dedicated to constitutional law and originalism are going to be put in a situation where it's either to contradict their own beliefs or to actually get rid of Roe. And if that happens, what will be the reaction and why will that reaction happen? And what drove Roe in the first place and what is still driving the whole idea of abortion? And is there a lot more involved in it than meets the eye? So that's what we're going to get into here. But at any rate, at issue in Dobbs, in the Dobbs case, is the fact that the law that prohibits elective abortions after 15 weeks, that's what the Mississippi law is aimed at and is going to do. That law that prohibits elective abortions after 15 weeks gestation cannot be rationally upheld on any ground that does not repudiate Roe and Casey. In other words, if the court determines that Mississippi has the right to enact that law. And according to the Constitution of the United States, Mississippi certainly does have that right. There is nothing in the Constitution of the United States that would stop that. Then it automatically overturns Roe. And if you rule against Mississippi, you automatically support Roe. So there isn't any way to get away from it. There is no way to compromise on this. But there is nothing in the Constitution or law that prevents a state from regulating abortion. It is either or. Either follow the law and the Constitution or fudge up an excuse not to. There's what the situation is. The six originalists would have to reject their own dedication to objective law in order to rule against Mississippi, to rule against the Dobbs case, because that's what the case is. Mississippi has passed a law saying that an elective abortions are prohibited after 15 weeks gestation, and Roe and Casey allow abortion almost right up to the time of birth, and we are even having cases that are in effect happening, you know, after the time of birth because of the way Roe is stated, because a woman has a right to have an elective abortion based on her own subjective consideration of her health, that is, of her mental situation. And, of course, that is purely subjective. So, in effect, there really can't be any prohibitions against abortion under Roe and Casey. And this is a restriction of abortion. And so if you rule in favor of Mississippi, which, of course, the constitutional law certainly allows, then you automatically rule against the restrictions in Roe, and you really rule against Roe itself. So this is what's going to happen here. And there is the factor of stare decisis. This is what the last court back in hearing Casey in 1991, the whole idea was that somehow or another the abortion question had been settled in stare decisis, that is, you know, the things that are, you know, in other words, something that has already been decided should stand. And that's what they grabbed on and latched on to use in order to justify not overturning Roe, even though there's all kinds of reasons that constitutionally it should be overturned. But here's what stare decisis really means. It means, literally, if you translate it from the Latin, it means stand by things decided and do not disturb settled points. But the point is here is that Roe has not been settled in 50 years. In 50 years, scholars have been arguing over Roe and arguing over Casey. And so it has not been settled, and that has been the whole problem. So actually, stare decisis requires that the court go back in and look at Roe and Casey and decide why it really hasn't been settled. And the reason it hasn't been settled is because it's bad law. So the stare decisis requires the whole thing to be considered, and it cannot be a factor in this decision here. It simply can't, because it would be, again, fudging. And if it was invoked, especially by the six originalists, everyone would know that they are simply giving in to pressure, and they are giving in to politics, and that they are concerned and worried about all of the fury and sound and fury that would happen if they overturn Roe. And everybody would know on both sides that this whole thing was politics and it wasn't following the law. So there's where we're at with this situation. So let's look in. The question is, but why abortion? Why so much ado and so much money given the pro-abortion issues and Planned Parenthood, for example? Is it just concern for feminism? Is it just sympathy for struggling women? Is it concern that children be wanted? I mean, there's all kinds of reasons that have been given about the people who are in favor and pro-abortion. But what are the real reasons? Those are all good reasons, but are they actually the real reasons? Why was the Blackmun Court, you know, back in 1973, driven so much to want to twist the Constitution in order to somehow justify abortion. It certainly seems that it's got to be more than that they were just concerned about the situation of women or concerned about the situation of children being wanted or not. And that there's a lot more to this. And so that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about what kind of reaction will there be if Roe is overturned, and why will that reaction be the way it is? Why will there be so much sound and fury? Because there certainly will. So what's going on here? What's really at stake, and what's really driving this whole abortion issue? And is it something a little bit more sinister and a little bit more nefarious than we've been told? And are the good reasons given for being in favor of abortion the real reasons? Is there something going a lot further deeper than this? And this is what we're going to talk about. And I want to start out here talking about the actual corruption of history that went on with the Blackmun Court in order to arrive at the Roe decision in the first place, and also the Casey decision that came about later on. They came about in 1991, I believe it was. It says, to a greater extent than even most of the opponents realize, the reign of Roe versus Wade has relied from the very beginning on a false and sometimes fraudulent version of history. Justice Harry Blackmun's majority opinion repeatedly cited slipshod scholarship that was already in the process of being discredited in 1973 and has since been comprehensively debunked. So in other words, Roe was based on scholarship about the history of this country that was not only faulty, but actually was distorted on purpose. It says, this mythology originated in the 1960s when a legal academic and abortion activist named Cyril Means Jr. began to claim that abortion had been a common law liberty at the time of the American founding and for many decades thereafter, and that when states outlawed abortion in the mid-19th century, they did so out of concern for its dangerousness to mothers rather than to protect unborn lives. This was the charge. Means' conclusions sometimes strain credibility. Subsequent investigations have shown that this assessment was an understatement. Means cited Samuel Farr's 1787 treatise on medical jurisprudence, which said that the early human embryo was not a human creature, and that a newborn with the same shape would be a monster indeed. Farr, though, was talking about the embryo's appearance. A few pages later, he wrote plainly that because unborn embryos may be supposed indeed from the time of conception to be living animated human beings, there is no doubt but the destruction of them ought to be considered a capital crime. So what Farr was talking about in this issue was that the appearance of embryos, if they were born like they look when they're first formed in the very early days of pregnancy, they would seem monstrous. But then he goes on to say, but they become human. And so from the very beginning, they are human. This is what he goes on. Means leaves that out and pretends that doctors at the time of the founding of this country believed that fetuses were not human beings, and that's simply not true. Then it goes on here. It says, Blackmun, in other words, during the 1973 decision, cited Means in six of Roe's footnotes, using the activist's historical inventions as his principal evidence that abortion may have been allowed at the time of the founding. In other words, he was trying to establish a precedent. He was trying to establish that abortion had once been a settled matter. He was trying to establish, in effect, stare decisis, you know, that had the matter had been settled when it never did. Means was advancing a self-consciously revisionist case. By 1989, though, supporters of Roe were presenting that case as an academic consensus. That year, 400 historians filed a brief to the Supreme Court urging it to reaffirm Roe in an abortion case it was hearing, Webster versus Reproductive Health Services. The historian's brief claimed that abortion was a common law liberty at the founding. And of course, this was totally untrue. So the question becomes, why was the Blackmun Court so interested in actually distorting constitutional law in order to arrive at a pro-abortion decision? And why were these professors of history doing the same thing? Was it simply out of the goodness of their hearts that they were concerned about women's rights, or they were concerned about women who may be in some kind of a bad situation because of an unwanted pregnancy? Or is there something a lot deeper and a lot further than this? It goes on. It says, the Webster brief had a big impact, however, on the public debate. Lawrence Tribe and Ronald Dworkin, the preeminent liberal constitutional theorists of their time, produced books about abortion. They explicitly relied on the brief that those historians put together in their discussion of history. To further back their contentions that women in the early 19th century used abortion to limit family size, the authors of the brief quoted a physician who wrote that abortion is not always associated with crime and disgrace. It may arise from causes perfectly natural and altogether beyond the control of the female. But those words suggest, and their context makes obvious, that the physician, going on here, Theodore Beck, was writing about miscarriages, which are this day sometimes described as spontaneous abortions. So these historians were deliberately misquoting Dr. Beck when Dr. Beck was talking about miscarriages, because miscarriages at that time were often called abortions. And in this case, that's exactly what he was talking about. And he was saying in a lot of cases, these things happen and they're no fault of the woman at all. And they're not done on purpose or anything like that. And he was not at all talking about the kind, you know, the elective abortion and deliberate abortion. So contrary to means, Blackmun and the historian's brief, abortion was certainly a crime in colonial times. Researchers have uncovered dozens of indictments for the killing of unborn children going back to the 13th century. The consensus that unborn children should be protected in law was robust enough to inform the laws of every U.S. state back at that time. So this has just been a total distortion of what really has been going on. And finally, the truth is that for centuries, Anglo-American law forbade abortion from the first time an unborn child was known to be alive. And so there was some issues over when quickening took place. It was thought, for example, that until you could feel the fetus moving around in the woman's womb, that the baby was not yet alive. We know better today. And in that case, if a doctor performed an abortion, no criminal charges would be filed against him. But on the other hand, if the woman's life was harmed or she was killed, because of the performance of the abortion, the doctor would have been charged with a crime, not just with malpractice, but with an actual crime. In other words, technically, the only reason a doctor would be not prosecuted because of an early abortion would be because the court could show that supposedly the baby yet was not alive. But if something happened to the mother, even if she had given that doctor permission, the doctor still could be prosecuted because he shouldn't have done it. I mean, this law has been on the books from the very, very beginning and all the way up through. So why so much trouble? Why so much trouble to show that somehow or another there was a precedent for abortion? And why so much trouble in 1973 for the Blackmun Court to arrive at a constitutional decision that was a distortion of the Constitution, and why so much concern later, and why some of the things vague things that were said, like Justice Kennedy, with this idea that somehow or another a person's idea of the universe and so forth allowed them to have an abortion. I mean, what's going on here? What is, what is the motive that is going deeper than what we're seeing on the surface here? And what are the real reasons that are going deeper than the reasons given in the first place? So that's what we're going to get at. And we'll get to that in the last section here. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Let's help pack the van for Catholic Charities. The St. Nicholas Charity on Wheels Ministry, a traveling van guided by Sister Michelle, needs donations for the poor in the Diocese of Peoria. We need your help to gather blankets, food, diapers, school supplies, canes, gift cards, towels, and more. Spirit Radio listeners can drop off goods on the first three Saturdays of December. Stop by the radio station on Boykins Place in Normal from 10 to 2 on Saturday. Visit CatholicSpiritRadio.com for details.
Christmas and year-end giving constitutes one-third of all charitable donations made annually. Please join others in supporting Catholic Spirit Radio during December. Donations do great good and are tax-deductible. What's more, the first $5,000 donated this month will be matched by two generous listeners. To give to our Christmas and year-end giving campaign, please visit our website at CatholicSpiritRadio.com today.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're talking about the Dobbs case in Mississippi that is being discussed by the Supreme Court. And we're talking about the fact that the Supreme Court decision that is going to happen over the next several months could very well overturn Roe. There's a very good chance that it will do that. And I've explained why that this might be the case. And we're looking into the distortions that were made to the Constitution in the first place back in 1973 and later in 1991 when Casey was heard. And actually Roe was expanded to be even more broadly interpreted so that it is almost impossible to put any restrictions on abortion at all. Almost any little thing can be overruled because of so-called women's health, which is very, very subjective because it incorporates both mental health as well as physical health. And it's very, very difficult to put anything on the books at all restricting abortion because of that. And the fact is that a lot of the information about our history was distorted in order to arrive at the Roe decision with the Blackmun Court. And I'm asking, what are the real reasons that a lot of this has happened? Why, other than some of the good reasons that are often given, what are the real reasons behind it? And that's what we're going to try and drive at here in this last segment. So stay with us. And it goes on here. It talks about the inhuman nature of the inhuman nature result of the Roe case. It says there is another reason to dismantle the lawless artifice of American abortion jurisprudence, namely that it is built on a conception of human identity and flourishing that is false, dangerous, and in no way required by the Constitution. Put another way, Roe versus Wade, Planned Parenthood and versus Casey and their progeny graft onto our Constitution a distorted understanding of what it means to be human. These precedents dissolve the parental relationship, atomize and isolate mother and child, and recast them as strangers locked in a zero-sum vital conflict. The court's misframing of the human context thus led it to invent a right to the use of private violence, suitable for repelling an intruder. In so ruling, the court cut off mother and child from possible public and private sources of genuine aid and protection. But okay, but why did the court do this? What was the real driving factor behind their decision? What was their thinking that caused them not only to disrupt the Constitution and not only to invent and corrupt history to try and prove that somehow or another abortion was legal in the early colonies, but now even drives them to, or drove them to, create an artificial situation in which mother and child are somehow opponents of each other. And somehow the child is a parasite and opposed to the welfare and well-being of the mother. What is that welfare and well-being? It's been very vaguely about the freedom, the idea of being able to have your own interpretation of the life and the universe and so forth, which is very vague, and also somehow that it's related to mother's health. But what is a little bit deeper here, and that's what we're starting to arrive at. It says here, the opinion is a paean to liberty of a very particular sort. It is the freedom of the unencumbered, atomized individual will to define and express its originality over and above outmoded social conventions and pursue a destiny of its own choosing. In the words of the opinion, the right to abortion springs from the freedom to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. The right to abortion frees a woman to make choices based on her own conception of her spiritual imperatives and her place in society, and to break away from outmoded and repressive norms regarding appropriate social roles. That all sounds very good, and it's all very vague, but again, what is that even driving at? Why all this flowery language and this idea of women must be free to decide and women must have this kind of, you know, what is the purpose of all this? Is that the only thing that is driving? Would people distort the Constitution, invent a false history of abortion in the United States, and distort abortion facts and facts of history and corrupt history itself in order to arrive at this idea that they must have this broad, wide type of freedom? I mean, would people spend millions and millions of dollars promoting abortion and funding Planned Parenthood and doing all of these things simply for that reason alone? That somehow they had this concept of a woman's freedom and freedom of people that had to be somehow expressed, and that all of this had to happen for that purpose. I think there's something more going on here. It goes on, it says, it did so pursuant to a narrative about human identity and flourishing that pits mother and child against one another in a zero-sum conflict between strangers, conferring on the former the right to use lethal violence, that is, conferring upon the mother the right to use lethal violence against the latter, against the child. I mean, would the court have done all of this and driven to this end simply because of some vague idea, philosophical idea about freedom? I don't think so. I think there's probably more going on here. And let's take a look and see if we can arrive at what some of that might be by looking at the predicted reactions that will happen if Roe is actually overturned. So let's look and see what would happen if Roe was overturned. And we can look here, and it says here, finally, the post-Roe abortion wars would not be waged by government alone. As in other culture war fights, there would likely be pressure on businesses and universities to boycott anti-abortion states and localities, as well as donors to anti-abortion politicians. We would probably see mass demonstrations in the streets and confrontations of judges and politicians. Hopefully, it would not escalate to violence. Pro-life Republicans should be prepared for all of this. Pro-abortion Democrats will be. An anti-Roe message could defend what the Supreme Court had done, but the question would move rapidly to the merits of banning abortion. So in other words, it's predicting here there would be a huge reaction against it. And the question again is, why? What is really going on here? It goes on, it talks about false reliance, that women depend on abortion in the way that the court has assumed. It says here, chip away at Casey's assertion that women rely on abortion for their participation in economic and social life, and there is not much left of the cases that have distorted constitutional interpretation and held U.S. policy hostage for 50 years. In other words, there's this whole idea, and we're starting to get closer to the truth, that somehow women must rely on abortion for their participation, and here it is, in economic, that's especially important, as well as social life. And that seems to be one of the huge driving forces of Roe and huge driving forces of the abortion movement in the first place. It says, the basic assumption underlying Casey's account of reliance interests is that children are an impediment to women's equality. And now we're starting to get closer to the truth. To be the equals of men, women need to engage in market work at the same rates and pace as men do. But the market requires unencumbered workers. Ipso facto, women must be unencumbered to participate, free from the demands of pregnancy and childbearing. And we're starting to move even closer now to what's really going on here, that there is something about abortion that is being driven by the modern technological society and its market mechanism. And somehow or another, women have to be the participants in this. Do they really? But is it really actually even driving solely and alone at women? Or is it driving at their husbands, and is it driving at men as well? It says the ability of women to participate equally in the economic and social life of the nation has been facilitated by their ability to control their reproductive lives. Thus, after Roe, greater numbers of women aborted, but the non-marital birth rate has exploded too. For not all women are willing to end the lives of their children. Ironically, in the world that Roe created, the risks of sex and the responsibilities of having children have been assumed disproportionately by women. For far too many men, children are no longer part of the sexual bargain. And again, why so? It seems here that there is a drive not only by the market to somehow or another make it possible for women to participate, but it also has resulted in men being separated from the idea of their children as well. The very idea of relying on abortion for women's equality would seem to have a rather nefarious historical analog. When Elizabeth Warren, then a Democratic presidential candidate, hailed abortion rights as economic rights, and when both state officials and corporate consultants speak of the business case for abortion, is not the logic eerily parallel to how Democratic legislatures in the South justified slavery? Slaveholders relied on enslaving black human beings for their economic well-being. Women workers, we are told, rely on ending the lives of their unborn children for the same reason. But is it really the women workers who are the major players here? Or are we getting closer to we get the idea that is it actually in the self-interest of employers, of big corporations, of big tech, of big pharma, and, a big business in general to have workers who are unencumbered by children and men who are unencumbered by wives with children? Is it in their interest to have these workers available because they become, for the corporation at least, better workers with less encumbrances, less distractions, and more dedication to the company, the corporation, and so forth itself? And in other words, a new paradigm and an entirely different model. And that seems to be the case if we go all the way back to 1973, and if we go back to these ideas of that women must have all of this special freedom and so forth, what it really seems to be is that employers of people in modern times benefit to a great extent of having a workforce that is unencumbered by children, unencumbered by the expenses that the work that the employer often has to meet and carry if its employees have children. And we see today that there is a huge bias in the workforce against women with children, especially single women with children, as now, because of abortion, so many marriages and so forth have been destroyed and families have been destroyed. It seems that there has been a factor running through our society and our modern technological society in which people without families, workers without families, workers without children, workers who are unencumbered are a lot more efficient. And I'm doing some speculating here, but I think there's been a lot of evidence pointing in that direction. And I think we take a look at the model that we have in China, where huge, huge numbers of wiveless men who are not married, huge numbers of men live in dormitories and so forth and work in the factories over there and do all of the labor and production and dedication to science and dedication to all of the technological needs of industry without all the encumbrances and burdens of children, and spend their whole lives, in effect, dehumanized as almost robot workers in the factories that are necessary. The suicide rate among these people is very high, and there is a huge drive by China. In fact, China had a one-child policy, supposedly based on the idea of reducing the population in order to make things better for the country and somehow or another to save the planet. And it could be that a lot of the green movement and so forth is incorporated into this whole new paradigm as well. And these are speculations on my part. I'm not saying here that the Catholic Church teaches this, because I'm obviously speaking on a Catholic station. But take a look at the direction these things are pointing in, and I think we have something driving the whole abortion case a lot more than just the idea of somehow or another freeing up women, or driven by compassion, or driven by some idea that people are entitled to this huge undefined freedom that Justice Kennedy invoked when he talked about the necessity of extending Roe even further than it was. It goes, the earliest women's rights advocates in this country knew that for women to participate more fully in the economic and social life of the nation would need to become far more hospitable to children and the women who bear them. The first woman to run for president of the United States in 1872 was not only an outspoken advocate of constitutional equality for women, she also advocated the rights of children, rights that, as she said, begin while yet they remain the fetus. Victoria Woodhull, and the women's rights advocates of her time knew what the 1970s feminist advocates of abortion would come to forget. The advancement of women will be possible only when the dignity of their children, born and unborn, is protected. And the fact is that the interest, it seems a lot, at least in this country and also in other countries around the world, especially China, is somehow to develop a workforce that is divorced from children, in fact, maybe actually divorced from family, divorced from marriage. It makes for a more docile workforce. It makes for a more efficient workforce. It makes for a workforce that can be more dedicated to the kinds of dedication that the modern corporations and technology needs. And I think there's something going on here a lot deeper, and there are reasons a lot more real than the reasons being given for what's driving the abortion case. And if you read about what might happen after abortion, the first thing that is referred to is there will be a huge reaction of corporations. It talks even about baseball teams. It talks about universities. It talks about large companies. It talks about technological companies. Will be doing everything they can to keep on driving the states to not restrict abortion, but actually to make the abortion more available. And there'll be an onslaught against the Republican Party that we'll have to endure and withstand in order to keep the rights of the states to restrict abortion going if Roe is overturned. And that alone, all that money and all that power and all of that intent shows that there's more going on here concerning abortion than just the reasons that are being given. So we're going to have to stop here. We're coming to the end of our program. Maybe we can talk about this more a little bit at some other time. Next week, we're going to talk about how important it is that the things that we're doing for our station and what we're doing and how we use donations that are given to us. So make sure you tune in next week to hear that. But ponder this and think about the fact that there may be a lot more going on about abortion than most of us have come to really realize. In the meantime, St. Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, and we humbly pray. And do thou, O Prince of the heavenly host, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all evil spirits who wander through the world for the ruin of souls. Amen.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN to Central Illinois 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at catholicspiritradio.com or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.